Why don't you, can you just say your name just to make sure that it's like picking?
Yep. My name is Axel John Adams.
Okay. And do you want to throat sing?
Yeah, I'll throat
just
sing.
Just to test out the throat singing capabilities.
Clear my throat a bit. Did it register it?
This is David Meyerson interviewing Axel Adams of F.H. King Students for Sustainable Agriculture. And also amateur. No, I shouldn't say amateur.
Yeah, definitely amateur.
Also a prodigious young Mongolian throat singer.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you do that when you're like working on the farm?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did it yesterday because I was out in that thunderstorm. I was trying to like throat sing down the thunderstorm, but it didn't work. No, but yeah, I do sometimes. Like, only when I'm out there by myself. I think this is true. Most of the people who work out there, if they're out there by themselves, they sing. It's because you're out there, no one else is around, and yeah. Cool. Why not? It's a good time to practice.
Awesome. Alright, well, in this interview, we're going to try to get to the bottom of this very interesting person. So,
it'll take approximately 3 minutes. No.
All right. Okay, so how about we start off? I'll ask you some questions about you and where you're from and all that. Where did you grow up?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's kind of complicated. So, I grew up, I was born in Madison. But then I like went to elementary school until I was about like 10 or 11 in Ryle, Wisconsin, which is in Columbia County. It's a town of about 900 people, super rural. And then, but then my parents were both teachers, so we had the summers off, and we'd spend the 3 months of summer up until I came to college in a one-room cabin without electricity or indoor plumbing in Sawyer County. So like a quarter of my life was spent up there, and that's where I think I did most of my growing up.
Where are Columbia and, did you say Sawyer County?
Yep. So Columbia County is one county north of Dane.
Okay.
And then Sawyer County is one county south of Lake Superior.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So Sawyer. You spent more time growing up, so like approximately when were you, did you say you're in Sawyer County longer?
Well, I was there for like a quarter of my life.
Okay.
I mean, 3 months out of 12 every year. But maybe it's like my own romanticization, but I like to say that that's where I'm from because like that's where I learned how to do a lot of things. That's where I learned how to do carpentry. I learned how to do lumbering, hunting, fishing, did a lot of reading and like hiking, and I definitely identify more closely with the town up there and the people up there than any place else I've lived.
Who taught you to do all that stuff?
My dad. Yeah, my dad's he was a carpenter. So my grandparents farmed, and then they got out of it. And they were pig farmers up by La Crosse, for a long time, since like before Wisconsin was a state on my dad's side. The first Adams came over from Scotland, and he was such a cheap son of a bitch that he wouldn't buy a horse. He got into New York Harbor, and instead of buying a horse, he got a dairy cow so he could drink the milk, and he walked the dairy cow to the La Crosse area and started farming.
When was that about?
Like early 1800s. And then, so then they're farming up there. And they were, my great-grandfather, Kenneth Albert Adams, was a pig farmer there and managed a couple different farms he rented out and bootlegged during Prohibition, and I was an electrician at the beginning of like electricity, so, and then he taught a lot of stuff to my dad. And then my dad was a carpenter for a long time. He built all the houses we lived in. And then now he mostly does fine woodworking stuff. And then he taught some of it to me.
So, wow.
Yeah.
So when did you, your family has its, that side of your family has its roots in the La Crosse area, and then your dad moved up to Sawyer County, to Columbia County?
Yeah, I mean, he bounced around for a bit, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about your mom? Does she come from a farming background?
Yeah, my mom's side, that's pretty interesting too, because it's, so my mom's last name's Evavold, and then, the story behind that is, so she's like third generation Norwegian, like, no, she's, yeah, third generation American, because her family on her dad's side came from Norway and settled in western Minnesota kind of during that big Norwegian immigration in the late 1800s, and they took the name Evavold because they were from the Evavole, which is like the Eva Valley of like northern Norway.
Okay.
And they were actually fishermen, and then they came over and started farming, and so that's the, and they still farm out there. They do mostly cattle, beef cattle and corn. And then on her mom's side, they came over from Poland. They were Jewish, but they said they were Catholics, and they were fleeing from the Bolshevik Revolution. And
so that's like early 20th century.
Yeah. And so they aren't, I don't think they ever did much farming. They did a lot of hunting, and like definitely a lot of hunting, a lot of like gathering. My great grandmother on that side was like an awesome mushroom forager. She knew all the types, and I wish I was old enough to have like learned from her, but she died when I was pretty young. But yeah, so that's kind of like the three areas: Scotland, Norway, and Poland.
How old were you when you started learning these various skills, woodworking, farming?
Well, I was like always around it, but yeah. I didn't really like.
Did your family own a farm?
No, we had 30 acres up in Sawyer County. We did. I mean, we had pigs up there and like feeder pigs and probably a half acre garden, and then we had another maybe quarter acre garden down like in Columbia County, and then. But no, they didn't. They didn't own a farm. My grandparents had sold the farm on my dad's side.
The garden and the pigs, were those just for us.
Yeah, we did a lot. I mean, when I was really young, we were pretty poor. I mean, my dad, when he met my mom, he had $1,200 in the bank, and she had $1,200 in credit card debt. So they started out with nothing, and so like a lot of when I was growing up, we were eating like venison, geese, wildfowl, like waterfowl, pheasants, rabbits, squirrels. I mean, yeah, kind of that. And then we knew a lot of farmers too, so we would get vegetables. We would like buy things in like big, ridiculous quantities and can it, or we'd be able to get like old geese and old ducks and stuff, that old chickens that were laying. And did a lot of that. But in terms of like when I actually started learning, was probably middle school, was when I started working for my dad. He would like hire me during the summer, and we would work carpentry and stuff. Mm-hmm. And really that was like the first point that I was not dumb enough to like start remembering and learning. But I was still pretty dumb. I mean, I'm still pretty dumb, but...
Okay. No, you're not. I never thought that. So you guys were pretty much self-reliant, it sounds like. in terms of what your family ate.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of it. Yeah, and we would buy beef from my uncle in Western Minnesota, and we would, that's what we ate. We ate that beef, and then we'd get several deer, and then geese.
Just caught in the wild that you would shoot yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, I've gotten at least one deer every year since I was 12, a couple of years too. And then now my dad does chickens. He has chicken tractors. I was out there with him on Wednesday. We butchered 25 chickens, and they were out again. Well, they'll be out again tomorrow to butcher another 25.
Wow. And sell them? To sell?
No. They split it with a friend, mostly, and then they don't have to buy chicken ever during the year.
Wow. Yeah. So you just freeze it?
Yeah. We got a couple of chest freezers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you kind of felt, I forget the word you use now, but that you kind of felt you identified with people in your neighborhood, other farmers from around where you grew up.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Like, what was your relationship with your neighbors or people down the road?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like, I mean, that'd be interesting. You never think about a relationship, really. It was just like there, but... Yeah. So in Sawyer County, we grew up... I mean, we were, like, right next to an Indian reservation.
Yeah.
And so we grew up listening to, like... We didn't have TV or anything because we didn't have electricity, but we listened to WOJB, which was, like, the Indian reservation radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty awesome. There were a lot of good shows. It was a really progressive radio station. And then there were a lot of people around us who were kind of like up there, you get really heavily into kind of like fringe hobby farms. Because in Sawyer County, the soil isn't so hot. But you get a lot of people who do some beef, but then a lot of people who are doing different poultry and llamas and stuff. And so we had some neighbors that did that. Then you get a lot of bear hunters. There's a lot of bear hunters up there, and so we knew them, and that was always interesting because you just hear their hounds bang, and they'd be chasing bears up trees and stuff. And then once in a while, the hounds will like get lost from their pack and show up in your yard, and you would think that like these dogs that chase down bears would be pretty rough, like vicious animals, but. Oh man, they're the biggest sweethearts ever.
They're nice to people.
Oh, they're so nice, and they like love any attention you give them. Like, you give them some water, they just love it. They're sweet dogs. But I don't know. I think up there too was wolves. That was always like a talking point because up there, like, wolves will kill livestock a lot.
Yeah.
Like, we knew one guy who he had draft horses. And the draft horses were in a blizzard. The wolves got out and hamstrung the draft horses, so they just bit the Achilles tendon, and the muscle just rolls up. And so the horses just fall down and freeze to death. And then the wolves came back and ate them. And then, like, wolves took down a lot of people up there do sheep and goats, but wolves would get a lot of them. And they'd get bear dogs sometimes. And so that was always like a talking point, like. Have you seen any wolves? And a lot of farmers up there, they just gut shoot wolves
if
they see them on their property. Which the reason they do that is because a lot of the wolves have collars, radio collars, and so the wolves will, if you gut shoot them, they'll run off a couple miles and die like far away, so they won't be able, DNR won't be able to trace it back to you.
Okay, so that's like. Something that DNR does to... It's illegal to kill a wolf
still in Wisconsin? Yeah, super illegal. I mean, they had a season for the first year, but yeah, to kill one without a permit, the fine is like $50,000.
Was this year the first year that wolves... There was an open season for wolves?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't endorse gut shooting wolves or anything, but that was definitely something that was going on.
But is the problem... Is the problem different up there than it is, say, in central Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. You have way more wolves. I mean, I've had a lot of close encounters with wolves. I've seen them kill stuff right under my deer stand and like snowshoe hares and things. And one time I was grouse hunting and it was getting pretty late. Was it grouse? Yeah. It's actually related to a chicken. It looks kind of like a chicken, but it lives in northern Wisconsin. It's a game, popular game bird. They're okay. really fast, and they're also called like spruce chickens because they nest in spruce trees. And one time I was hunting those, and it was getting pretty late and starting to get dark. And wolves have this like hunting call. And it's kind of like this hooting noise, like an owl. And I was, I don't know, a couple miles from our cabin, and like I hear the hooting call like on my right, like in kind of like a ways off, and then I hear it on my left, and then like out in front, and it's just like, oh shit, I gotta get him. I'm going home. And then well, kind of along those lines, one of my favorite stories was, so one year we had pigs and we had them in this enclosure. And one night, a bear came in, and they had the enclosure was made of like this 6-foot horse fencing, which is made of really heavy gauge steel, kind of steel mesh. And the bear pushed down the fence to try to get in, and couldn't quite get over the fence, even though I'd pushed it down, and then had like wandered off, and so. We came out in the morning and the pigs were freaking out. And we'd had some problems with bears before. We had a lot of problems with bears. Up there, they're kind of used to people. But the DNR says what you're supposed to do is you take a shotgun with a slug and you fire over them. Like, you just shoot kind of in their direction, but over them, and it scares them off. Mm-hmm. And we've done that before, and it seemed to work. So my dad is like, okay, Axel, if you see the bear around, this shotgun is loaded. It's a Winchester Model 12 pump shotgun. And he's like, this shotgun's loaded. Just fire over the bear, scare it off. I was like, okay, that sounds reasonable. And so he's like, kind of late at night, and I was out taking a leak and in my boxer shorts. I think they were Mario boxer shorts. And so I'm standing there like, oh shit, there's the bear. And so I go back inside and get the shotgun. And meanwhile, the bear had come closer and was then like standing up. And so I was like facing the bear with the shotgun. I didn't want to shoot now because the bear's standing up and moving around. I didn't want to hit the bear. And so I'm just like there ready. And then the bear finally like kind of just gets back down and runs off. And then my dad comes out of the house just laughing his ass off and tells me that he had unloaded the gun like earlier. I don't know why he had it loaded, but then he had decided he was going to unload it. And so then I'd been facing down this bear in my underwear with an empty gun.
Sounds lucky.
Yeah, it was a good one. But
okay. So bears legal to kill in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a license. It takes 5 years to get a license. Yeah, you have to apply for a preference points, and you get so many preference points, and then you get a tag.
What's which is more hated in your
wolves.
Neighborhood?
Wolves. No one cares about bears, really. I mean, bears are a nuisance because they, like, get in your garbage, and
yeah.
And sometimes they, like, pester, like, get in chicken coops and stuff and pester people's pets, but they're pretty timid.
Yeah?
Yeah. But then so once in a while you do get a big boar bear, and they'll like, kind of go rogue and start going after pigs and shit. But, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Maybe I can get you to talk more about the Indian reservation. That what tribe?
It was
Ojibwe,
yeah. But it was the Kudaraya reservation, which is a pretty big one. And they're pretty affluent. They have a successful casino,
mm-hmm.
but and they have a lot of problems. I've also spent some time up on the Bad River and Red Cliff reservations, and those are right on Lake Superior. And those are much poorer reservations, and they have a lot more problems. I was on for a little bit, on the Red Cliff reservation. They have like kind of a budding community garden setting up that's just getting going.
And so is that recently since you became an FH King?
Yeah, that's since I've been up there. Yeah, but it was cool because I was on there like talking with the guy and he gave me some seeds. But he was then like during that week he was going to fly to the White House actually to be like to meet with because Michelle Obama has like that gardening program thing, and he was meeting with her with a bunch of other people who had cool programs. So I mean, it was nice to see that they're getting some publicity.
So what's their, what do you know about their community garden up there?
Well, I mean, it's just starting out. I mean, it's pretty small. And it's not like a community garden in the sense where everyone gets a plot.
Yeah.
It's like a community farm. So there's like one guy in charge. And then they've got some vistas from AmeriCorps that work up there too. And then they get people who volunteer and then they sell it back to the community. But it's like trying to get the community to invest in itself, if that makes sense.
So they grow food for the reservation.
For the reservation, yeah. But there's been a movement. There's a guy on campus from the Oneida tribe, and he's trying to get more of reservation like produce and products down into like Madison, Milwaukee areas where there's more of a market.
For locally grown or organic foods.
Yeah, and they're trying to do. I mean, a lot of what they're trying to do too is grow more like specialty items, which are going to cost more, be more lucrative, and so
things. What's like, an example of?
Well, like wild rice. Wild rice would be an example, or things that are foraged. Like different fungi. I helped out with a plan and do a benefit dinner for the Red Lake Reservation this last November. They've got like a youth summer camp, and we were raising money for them, and we did it. It was like kind of a pop-up dinner, and we did it using the kitchen for Madison Sourdough, and I think we raised about $3,000 from that dinner. But yeah, they brought down a ton of game and like wild rice and some forage things. And then we got produce that was donated from a couple different CSAs nearby, and we were able to make like a pretty fantastic 5-course meal through the main organization that was doing it was Eat for Equity. And the woman who runs that, Casey Bilyeu, is like a FH King alumnus. Yeah. So she used to be the admin director, and now she runs that, and that's how I know her. And we worked on that. We worked on that, and it was great.
Cool. And the proceeds went to benefit what? Expanding?
Well, it was just, I think more than anything, it was kind of maintenance stuff, and like they needed to make some changes to like just infrastructural changes. So that was pretty cool. It was cool because a bunch of kids came down from the reservation and helped serve, and it was cool meeting them, and I think they appreciated it.
So would you say, I mean, how about this? What is, where does most of the food that people on the reservation eat, where does it come from? Is it food that they grew?
No way, man. No, it's coming from the commodities program. So it's all coming from, the majority is coming from subsidized ag, big corn, big soy, really highly processed stuff. And that goes back, way back to after, kind of like there was that big assimilation push in the early 1900s where a lot of Native American children were taken from the reservation and put in boarding schools. And then around that time too, they started the commodities program, and so they were just bringing onto these reservations white flour, sugar, oil, and like you hear things about like Indian fry cakes or fry bread. That's like what they could make because they had corn oil, white flour, and sugar. So they just fried the dough. It's not a traditional Native American food, but a lot of people associate it with Native Americans. And then that commodities program is what has caused. That's why you have such high rates of diabetes and alcoholism on the reservation. And you run into people on the reservation who have diabetes, alcoholism, multiple drug addictions. They're losing body parts because they're getting amputated from the due to diabetes. They're huge abscesses, and it's a huge problem.
So they're eating a lot of foods like with high fructose corn syrup in them.
Yeah, just crappy refined food. Yeah.
Like, what are a few examples?
Well, I mean, like you go down through a grocery store and you see kind of all the, I don't know, just crap, you know, like refined cereals, surefined cereals, and really highly processed meats, hot dogs, things like that. Mm-hmm. You do have some people who are trying to get back to more traditional lifestyle, and there's a big project being undergone by the Great Lakes Fish and Wildlife Commission, GLFWC. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make a cookbook of all traditional recipes that didn't have any like Western influences, and they had a hell of a time because a lot of that knowledge has been lost. There are definitely people who do hunt and gather, but a lot of them, they have convenience stores on the market, like convenience store kind of food, you know, like you stop at a gas station and that's what's there, chips and those little squishy cake things, I don't know what they're called.
Okay.
But,
so is that like, are there actual grocery stores on the reservations you've been to?
The ones I've been to, no. It's like, they're like big convenience stores. And so that's a huge, you talk about food deserts. Indian reservations are major food deserts. And a lot of people on the reservation don't have cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, they're stuck with what's there. And what's there is maybe a food pantry, and then things like, convenience stores.
Hmm. Okay. I think we should get back to F.H. King, although this is really interesting.
It is interesting stuff.
So, and I think that you've kind of given me an idea of what the answer to this is already, but why is it that you think that you got involved with F.H. King when you started coming here?
I read his book in high school. It was interesting kind of how I got really heavily into sustainable agriculture. I was really interested in sustainable forestry. I remember I read this article in the 2008 October National Geographic on redwood forestry and how they were doing selective cuttings, and it was just, oh man, I thought that was fantastic how they were managing those forests. And I got really into the idea of agroforestry, and then that kind of changed. I read this book called The Untold Story of Milk, which is a story of kind of the whole raw milk debate and kind of where a lot of the history of American dairy, and got really interested in dairying and kind of like conventional agriculture versus a more sustainable method.
What's the raw milk debate?
Well, raw milk debate is it's a really interesting topic. So what happened is milk was never pasteurized. It was always sold raw until like the want to say it was actually the '50s when the law went in that they all had to be pasteurized in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
To prevent brucellosis, which is like bovine tuberculosis, kind of, which people can get to. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, but if I'm wrong,
the record
I'm
will
wrong.
Show it.
Yep, the
and
record
history
will show
will
it.
Know
yep,
forever.
History will show I'm an idiot. No, but yeah, but what happened is, so at the turn of the century, you had a lot of these things called slop dairies, and what they were is they're dairies that were on the outskirts of major cities, and what they were doing is they were feeding the cows brewer grains, brewer's mashes, from like distilleries and breweries. And that's basically all those cows had. They were like early CAFOs. And so those cows were eating this mash and they were getting really sick. They were getting huge sores on their sides. But then people were getting the milk and drinking the milk and getting sick because, of course, these cows are in these terrible conditions. And so they started pasteurizing at the turn of the century some of this slop dairy milk, and it was better because people weren't getting sick. It still wasn't good milk because it was from sick animals. But so that was kind of the start of pasteurization. And then in the 50s, there was a bigger push to pasteurize milk, and it really played to the interest of big dairy and the Milk Marketing Board, because with pasteurization and with homogenization, they could... milk would have a longer shelf life.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, with any kind of like distribution chain, when you have a longer storage, that's always good. And so the Milk Marketing Board was a huge lobbyer for like pasteurization. Yeah. In Europe, you can buy raw milk pretty much anywhere. And raw milk from healthy cows is totally safe. I've had raw milk lots of times. I've never been sick. Yeah, so I got really interested in kind of like farmers' rights, and I still think that it's the prerogative of the farmer. If the farmer has healthy cows and he wants to sell his cows directly to consumers, that's his get-go. If they get sick, he'll have to answer for it. But I think that's pretty fair. But it would totally undermine kind of these big four milk companies like Dean and Kemp's, and there are a couple others. Because the going rate for farm fresh milk, like raw milk, is about $10 a gallon, and they get like something absurd, like $1 a gallon or something, when they sell it to these distributors. It was probably even less than that. It's probably like 30 cents on the gallon. Mm. I don't know the price right now, but and that's the subsidized cost even. And so what would happen is you just have a ton of small farmers who would start selling directly to consumers, doing CSA type things, which I think would be sweet, but the Milk Marketing Board wouldn't. But anyway, I digress.
This is on track. This is kind of what I wanted to get at, is why what you think is wrong with, or not necessarily wrong, but what it is that interests you about this different kind of agriculture.
Yeah. And so, well, I read that book, and I thought, I mean, you had to take some parts of it with a grain of salt, but I really enjoyed that. And then I got into reading a bunch of different sustainable agriculture books. A lot of them were pretty classic. A lot of them were kind of tied to permaculture and the idea of forest agriculture and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then I came across Farmers of 40 Centuries by F.H. King, and I read that, and was really, I mean, really thought that was an amazing book. And then I moved here into the dorms, and the day I moved in, I like moved all my shit in and was just kind of like knocking about on campus and ran into Harvest Handouts, and it said like F.H. King. I know that guy, I read his book. And then I went up and started talking with Mark Sandberg, who used to be our program director, about F.H. King's book, and then I started volunteering out there, and kind of that's how I got involved. But then I've been involved ever since, whether they liked it or not. But
and you're now, I guess we should have gotten this out of the way, but what's your position now?
I'm the garden director. Yeah, so I'm kind of the senior garden director, so I'm in charge of kind of maintaining the garden, training the junior garden director, who's Galen. I don't know if you've met him, but I'd shown him where all the stuff is and how to do greenhouse things. And yeah, so I guess that's my position.
Okay. How many people are in FH King?
That's a good question. I mean, there are 8 people on our board, and then we've got probably 20 interns, and then there's, I don't know, 2,000 people on our listserv. And so, and then, every time you have harvest handouts, there are about 100 to 150 people there. So, yeah, who knows?
In your experience, at least from the people that you interact with or that you know well in FH King, do a lot of them also come from farming or rural backgrounds like you?
No way. Most of them, Galen does. He's from up by Viroqua. Most of them are urban kids who are like, this might be one of their first exposures, or they've like woofed and really enjoyed that, and so then they want to stay involved, and they become involved with FH King, or they are like CNE SOCH students who hear about FH King. Yeah, but the vast majority of them are from urban or suburban backgrounds. Yeah.
Is the composition of FH King mostly, do you think it's a cross-section of the university in terms of, you name the terms. Is it a cross-section of the university?
Yes and no. Like, in terms of, like, if you look at LNS,
yeah,
it's a cross-section. I mean, you got some hard science students, you've got some humanities, like, you got a lot of art majors, some English majors, history, geography, geology, you've got soil science majors, Cal's, you get some, and you get some hort, some agronomy, what am I talking about? Yeah, it's definitely a cross-section of the university.
Yeah.
We've got some, business students. I mean, that's awesome. Yeah, so we get a little bit of everyone. Most, I'd say that, but if you polled everyone who'd ever been involved in FH King, the most common major would probably be CNE. So, yeah, there are a lot of people.
That makes sense. There.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Okay. Are there how long has FH King been at the spot where it is now on the west side of campus?
7 or 8 years, yeah. But FH King's been a student org since 1979. It started out.
What did you guys do before?
Well, it started out as just kind of a group of agronomy students. Do you know the history of F.H. King, really? Or?
Sort of,
yeah. He was
For the sake of posterity.
He was the first chair of the soil science department. Back then it was called soil physics.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Yeah, he's the first chair of that department, and this was in the late 1800s. He was from Whitewater/Vermont, I think, and born in 1848. But then, yeah, he worked here. He was kind of a Renaissance man. I mean, he did a lot with soils, but then he also wrote like this giant encyclopedia on bird migrations. And he invented the syndrilical silo. So, like, you see all those syndrilical silos all over, or even harvest stores, which are derived from there. He invented them to minimize waste, because you get a lot of waste in the corners. So, yeah, he's kind of a man about town. And then he went to work for the USDA as kind of an undersecretary, I think. I don't know his exact position. He worked there for like a really short period of time, was canned because his views were too progressive. He didn't like the way that agriculture in the U.S. was going. He was a lot of the soil was being depleted, a lot of really bad erosion, and he thought that was whack. And so then he went on a tour from 1907 to 1909 through China, Japan, and Korea, looking at how these farmers have been able to farm that land for 3,000 years without destroying it. And that's when he wrote Farmers of 40 Centuries. And so in 1979, just like a bunch of agronomy students, this is the 70s, they're like, oh, this is great. We need to kind of have this activist group. And so a lot of the stuff they did was kind of like, they had a lot of discussion groups and just kind of awareness things. And then I think it's only been like the past 10 or 12 years that we've had a garden space. And it used to be over by the Walnut Street greenhouses. And then they built that power plant. And then we moved over to Eagle Heights. So that was that.
What was at Eagle Heights before that?
Well, I mean, there have been a lot of things at Eagle Heights. Back in the early days of the university, that whole area was cornfields. And that's where they did, I mean, the whole area is a farm. Mm-hmm. And so they grew corn on there for a long time and did research out there. And then they moved because Madison was expanding. And then it became the Lakeshore Nature Preserve relatively recently. And then it was in sometime in the 70s. Or late 60s, that the Eagle Heights Community Gardens was established there. And that used to include all of the Biocorp Prairie up there, all used to be Eagle Heights Community Gardens. And then about 7 years ago, the Biocorp Prairie acquired that and started doing prairie restoration, which doesn't really make sense because in the natural history of that spot, there's never been a prairie there ever. It's been oak savanna. I mean, before there were people, it was oak savanna. There's never been a prairie. And so they've had a hell of a time. They're not doing prairie restoration. They're doing prairie installation. And so they've had a hell of a time like keeping that going because they just can't outcompete the weeds. But that whole area used to be Eagle Heights Community Gardens. And then the same time when that power plant was built about 8 years ago, that's when you had F.H. King move over, and then also Ed Woolsey and Jim Nienhuis, who are two ag researchers, they moved over there and set up their plots, which are across from ours.
So their plots being separate from F.H. King's?
Yeah.
Has it always been, so you said... it was sometime. Well, did you say when exactly you moved into the garden?
When we moved to Eagle Heights.
Yeah.
It was 8 years ago.
Okay, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And before that, you were in by the Walnut Street greenhouse.
Yep.
Has it always been totally run by students? It is totally run by students.
Now. Yeah, I mean, we've got advisors, but they're. They don't really do much with us. We're trying to get more involvement from advisors just because they'll lend us greater legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be able to just carry more brunt. We're trying to get like certified as the like student garden, student farm, and there's been talk of maybe having like another one in another area, but that's a long ways down the road. But we've got...
Mm-hmm.
Our advisors right now, there's Michael Bell, who's in CNE Soch, but he never has anything to do with us. We have no contact with him, really. Then there's Erin Silva, who's in agronomy, and she's pretty awesome. And then Amy Charkowski, who's in plant pathology, and she's pretty awesome, too.
What kind of advice did they give you?
Well, Aaron Silva, I mean, those both of them have only been associated with F.H. King recently, and just in the past year, actually. And Aaron Silva was working on a big grant to do urban agriculture types of things. I don't know what exactly. And so we've been working with her, and she's been giving us advice on how we can change things. And then Amy Charkowski has been really good in terms of like talking about ways of how we could potentially develop a way of having our own revenue stream if we ever like lost our funding from ASM.
Mm.
And so we've played around with a couple ideas with her. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of a budding relationship. It doesn't really.
Yeah. Have you, so you, I've seen, and you were talking about earlier how Harvest Handouts, you mm-hmm. can serve, you can get 100 people,
mm-hmm.
like probably what, like a bag of vegetables,
yeah,
like a plastic bag full of vegetables mm-hmm. every time you have one of those.
Mm-hmm.
In the past that you know, has there always been a Harvest Handout, or how far back does that go?
That's a good question. I don't know how far back that goes. We used to have a CSA.
Really?
Actually, yeah, that served the Eagle Heights residents, people who lived in new housing. And so, but that got the university kind of put the kibosh on that because they said that there were local CSAs that were complaining and saying that was an unfair advantage because we had university funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't able to do that anymore. And then I think Harvest Handouts is pretty recent, actually, like the last 4 years. Well, no, not last 4 years. Maybe last six. I don't know. As long as we had a trailer. But that's actually a really good question. I don't know.
Okay. So glad I asked a good question.
Yeah, they've all been good questions. But that was a really good question.
Is it... So it's for legal reasons, then, that you started giving away your what you grow for free?
Yeah, we can't charge because we get our funding from student segregated fees. It ends up working out that every student pays like $1.20 to F.H. King, and then if we charge them, we'd be like double charging them. We can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, we just give it out for free. We donate a lot to Community Action Coalition.
What's Community Action Coalition?
Community Action Coalition of Dane County is an organization that kind of stocks food pantries throughout Dane County. And so they come out on Mondays and pick up produce from us and take it back to their warehouse and then distribute it. They have a big free like cooler area and distribute it to food pantries kind of everywhere.
From what you know, for how long has F.H. King been able to supply both Harvest Handouts for as many people as that come to Harvest Handouts and
CAC,
yeah.
Yeah, that's been since the CSA ended. And the CSA ended 4 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Has the farm always output as much as it's as much produce as it is now?
That's a good question.
Or about.
Yeah. Between you and me, and whoever is listening to this, we're pretty bad at keeping records. And so it's hard to judge, like, how much it produces each year. Because, like, scales break, and then people fudge the books. And so, like, there was a time where there'd be, like, you look back, and there'd be, like, someone will say, like, we produced, like, $60,000 worth of produce. And then the very next year, the same person would be like, it's, like, $20,000. It's like, I don't think it changed that much in a year, like the amount you produce. But, I mean, we've never had two double stack trailers coming into Harvest Handouts.
Yeah.
We've never done that before. So, I mean, I think.
But is that what you're doing now?
That's what we're doing now. I think that we're maybe more productive.
What do you think you owe that to?
Me being so goddamn smart. No, I'm kidding. No, no. Well, I think that this year particularly, last year that was certainly not the case with the drought, but this year we had a lot of moisture. Things have been doing really well. We've had a lot of great interns. We've been able to get a lot done. We've done a lot of successive planting. I've stayed on longer than any other garden director, so this is like I'm past my 2-year mark. They ask for a 2-year commitment, but not very many people do full 2 years. A lot of them leave after a year, year and a half. And so what I've noticed is like the first year I was an idiot. Like I wasn't very good at managing the space. I mean, I was able to produce stuff, but I didn't have the timing down for like successive plantings and how to kind of maximize space. And this year I have a way better idea of how to like time things better so that things peak at certain times and we have a lot. If I was here another year, it'd be even better, but I won't be. So I think, yeah, a lot of it's just like figuring out how to time this, especially how to time it so it's manageable with school. Yeah. Because in the spring, we always have kind of a late start because right the time where you could start planning is kind of like you're coming into finals.
Mm.
So no one can spend much time in the garden then. But
I kind of, as a side note, because I realize I've left a timeline of your life almost entirely out of this interview, I think. So you started coming here, your freshman year was
2010.
Yeah. And you started volunteering that year, and then you became garden director
August 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this year is 2013, 2014, yep. And you're going to be garden director this
until,
year.
Yep, I'll be garden director through the rest of the season, so I'll end in like December.
Okay.
And then we've already got Galen, who's a new guy, and then we'll hire someone else, hopefully over winter break or beginning of the semester, and then also be around to train them in the greenhouses, but I won't be being paid by FH King. Mm-hmm. It'll be their garden. They'll be the ones investing in it for the season. So I'll be kind of like, yeah, just kind of making sure they don't fuck up too bad. It's just like someone who's been in the greenhouse has to be there to like show them where things are, tell them who to contact in physical plant and things like that. Pass down our secret recipe for potting mix and
The greenhouse is that's what greenhouse you're talking about?
King Greenhouse behind King Hall, and that's where we do all our like seed starts, like our tomato transplants and peppers and eggplants. And
you start them in the winter.
Yep, we start them about the end of March.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's where you train all your new incoming executives?
No, just the garden directors. The other board members don't spend much time in the greenhouse, or the garden for that matter, which is kind of frustrating because...
What do they do?
Well, they spend a lot of time in the office doing stuff. I don't know. I mean, they do a lot. I don't know exactly what they do. Like, they do a lot of planning and organizing and taking care of finances and but yeah, they don't spend a lot of time in the garden really.
You guys are kind of separate.
Yeah, kind of. Like the two garden directors are always really close, and then the two garden assistants who are close, garden directors, and then the garden interns, and kind of like that's like one group, and then you have like finance director, admin director, program director, education director, urban ag director, and they're kind of like off doing other stuff like programming, workshops, things like that.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we're about pretty close to the end of
pretty good, yeah.
Where, yeah, we've been talking for almost an hour now. Is there something else you want to talk about? Just anything in general you want to put on the record of this?
Yeah, what do you think about robots? No, no. I'm trying to think of like a really good story of like
that's some, what this is about. It's something stories,
something crazy. And of course, I'm not gonna be able to think about it right. Oh, okay, here's a good one.
Okay.
Well, we've had, I mean, since we're in an urban area and we do everything with bikes, we've done some pretty dumb stuff, like just like kind of impractical, like hauling lumber 6 miles from the east side.
What do you need lumber
Home
for?
Depot, like trellising and stuff.
Okay.
On bike trailers to the garden. Or, but one of my favorite ones is we did this last September. I had a contact in Hoofers Equestrian, and she said, "Well, we got a bunch of horse shit," and I was like, "Oh man, I'd love to get some of that horse shit." But we were like, "Where are we gonna put this in? It's out in Belleville. How are you gonna bring it back?" And so, we were like thinking we couldn't, as students, we couldn't rent a fleet vehicle,
especially not the photo,
and like a big, or like a big truck, like a big flatbed truck or a dump truck. And so we were like, "We'll rent a U-Haul." And so we got a pickup truck, and then we rented a U-Haul and drove it out to Belleville and filled it full of horse shit. But U-Haul, I mean, you can't return the thing all covered in horse shit because then you get charged a bunch of money. So we put it all in like the giant, like 60-gallon leaf bags, you know, like those big hefty bags or whatever.
Right.
So it was just like several hundred of these bags full up of horse shit in the back of this car, or back of this big U-Haul trailer. And then we drove it out to the garden and put it out there, and then returned the U-Haul. And I bet they were pretty confused when they looked in the U-Haul, and it was spotless, but it smelled like piss. That was a pretty good one. That's probably my favorite story.
Did you guys get fined for it?
Nope. Went off without a hitch. Yeah. But we also did something similar with a guy's minivan and llama poop. But that was...
Is there a llama farm around here?
Yeah, there's one right outside of Madison, and wonderful old lady. And so we just went out there, and we had like a bunch of Rubbermaid containers and just packed this minivan full of Rubbermaid containers full of llama shit. And just like did a bunch of trips, and that was pretty fun.
And was there? So this is like a couple of years ago.
Yeah, this would have been when I just started, like the October of 2011. When I started.
Do you, is that like something that had been done? Is that something that's new with your administration?
Yeah,
using a lot of animal poop.
We use all the animal poop we can get. It used to be that. They would, when they cleared out the manure lagoon at the dairy barn, they'd bring that out for us. But they renovated the dairy barn these last 2 years, so I'm the garden director, so we haven't got any of that. So we've had to get creative. And then now I think the dairy barn is reestablished. So like next year we'll be able to get that manure. But yeah, we had to seek out other sources of poop.
Cool. Alright. I don't know. If you don't have anything else, I think that we can probably wrap this up.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds all good. Right. I've spoken enough about myself. I'm embarrassed.
No, man. This has been great. Thanks a lot for doing this. And I'm sure the archives will appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay. Until next time.